I realize that this was a real rough morning for Alaska, and that you had a hard time getting here. This is the kind of mornings that we have every day in Washington. And so I managed to get up at 6 o'clock and get over here, and found that I had hoped that Mr. Eaton was going to be here to help me, but he wasn't here. And so we have worked a while this morning putting together this arrangement, which I think is going to prove very satisfactory for the program. I'll fill in the details about where we have our meetings after we've had the presentations, because I am sure that there'll be more people here. We are dealing here with a historic issue. Ever since the founding of this country, the United States has had a manifest destiny, as it has been described by some historians, and it has moved through a series of thrusts. And these thrusts have always been into and by means of a new frontier. Back at the turn of the century, or not long after it, Frederick Jackson Turner stated a thesis that the whole history of the United States could be interpreted through the significance of the frontier. And as we examine it, we see that there's a great deal of validity to it. In the later stages of his life, he said, "I think I should rewrite that particular paper. I would restate it now. I would say that the frontier has passed, and that the United States is moving into a completely new kind of an experience, what he called an urban frontier." He never wrote that paper, and it was left for his students to interpret him as the years have gone ahead. And some of them have done it. And there's been a very significant book just published that traces once again the impact of the frontier on American history, and along with it, the meaning as this particular historian interprets it, namely that Americans were always opening up frontiers because they had to enlarge their markets. A capitalistic and free enterprise economic system demanded ever enlarging markets. And this application of Frederick Jackson Turner's thesis is very brilliantly done in a new volume. And it has application to Alaska. Indeed, the volume refers to Alaska as the new frontier, the last frontier, and it treats it not only as a frontier in the same sense that Frederick Jackson Turner treated the frontier, but it also points out the opening up of a marketplace in Alaska. And we've been moving around that idea ever since we started this program here together several weeks ago now. Last evening, Dick Cooley very brilliantly pointed out that after almost a century, the political constraints and the economic constraints that have been imposed upon Alaska have been removed. And now the task is for Alaskans to develop the kind of political program, to develop the policies that will push Alaska ahead onto these new levels. It's no longer a colonial possession of the United States. It's no longer a matter of being subject to national policy. The time has come for Alaska to assert an Alaska policy. And this is what we're trying to do together here in this particular program. But more importantly, perhaps, Dick, in some ways, than even the removal of the political and the economic restraints or constraints, whichever you choose to call them, has been the removal of geographical constraints. For a time, Alaska was a relatively difficult place to reach, but now the new technologies have not only made it easy to get to Alaska, but it have made it easy to get around over Alaska. And so the feedback from technological change is going to cause great new developments here in Alaska. And we're trying to identify those developments so that we can trace what their significance are going to be in the next 5 years or in the next 10 years. What if telemobility, as it's described in the article that I sent you that was published in the Kaiser News, what if telemobility, or what when telemobility comes to Alaska? Of course, it's already here. You have several other meetings in the city today, and all of these meetings are largely being prompted by the realities of the technological changes that have overtaken not only all the rest of the world, but have overtaken Alaska. And it's the impact of this technological change that threatens the kind of Alaska that it has been. We've talked about the new infrastructure that you would have to put into Alaska. You're not only talking about the hardware that has to be put in here in order to sustain the institutional technology or the social technology. You're not only talking about that, but we're talking about the tremendous changes that confront you in these few years ahead of you. If you did take the time to read that article by Herman Kahn and Kahn and Wiener that I suggested that you read out of that book toward the year 2000, if you took the time to read that, and in that framework for speculation, if you ask yourself something about the significance of some of these developments for Alaska, if you speculated a little bit about the future of Alaska, you must have begun to see the tremendous impact that so much of this new technology is going to have upon Alaskans and upon the Alaskan way of life. And so we come here to this session to talk about something that's tremendously important to all of you. That is the impact of technology upon your environment. Understand something about how it upsets the ecological balance. And ask ourselves what you think to be the capacity of the Alaskan ecological base. That can be studied by scientists, and they can tell you somewhat the kind of population and the kind of developments that the ecological base here in Alaska can sustain. But underneath all of it should be a desire on our part to make Alaska a unique place. I mentioned this Mid-Canada Corridor concept, which covers Canada from the White Horse up in the Yukon Territory all the way over to the James Bay. A completely new concept for the redevelopment of a Canada that would be unique with its own character and not be a reflection of the United States. Last week there was a television show for an hour on Siberia, which showed, and apparently with a great deal of integrity, showed what the Soviet Union is doing in developing Siberia and to adapt to the ecology of Siberia. And it was a unique kind of a response that was being proposed to what the Soviet Union has found in its Siberian north. Now, I would think that there are other aspects of the Alaskan scene that should be of tremendous meaning to us, but perhaps the one that does engage the interest of you as Alaskans and of all of the people of this country and abroad is the one of the environment. And we do have here in these few days, here in these plenary sessions, we do get some input, and then I believe it's in those policy planning sections that we can really make our progress. Dick and Ed, I say that to you because it's there that all of you, and I want to make that very clear, all of you have an input. You can make your contribution. I said at the beginning of this program that the wisdom resided in you, and certainly the knowledge and understanding and the wisdom about Alaska is yours, and there in those policy planning sections, you can put it together to pronounce a policy on how you want Alaska to look and the way you want Alaska to be 5 years from now and 10 years from now. And so with that, Dick, I think I'll have you continue the presentation that you started last evening, and then we'll hear from Dr. Edward Higbee.
All right. I've got a watch, by the way, to...
I'll put it here.
I can keep an eye on it. Well, this morning I would like to deal with two specific but related points that I raised last night. The first one is the need to design new political institutions that can foresee and forestall environmental crises rather than merely reacting to them after the fact, which too often is the case today at almost all levels of government. And the second point that I would like to devote some time to concerns the knowledge inputs that must go into the political system if you are to achieve a balanced, rational management of this northern environment. I think we can begin by identifying certain central issues involved in any consideration of environmental policy. And I have five different issues that I would like to review briefly for you that I think are pertinent here or anywhere else where we're faced with the problems of how to design new institutions to meet these problems. First, of course, there is a need for a better definition of goals and priorities, and a related need for a clearer overall view of the dimensions of the environmental quality problem. The key to understanding this, of course, is in realizing that the environment is highly complex and interwoven with the set of ecological interrelationships in which everything seems to be related to everything else, and that if we interfere with one element of the system, it'll cause repercussions throughout the whole system. And it therefore is in relation to the whole that each interference must be evaluated. This requires sort of a recasting of our thinking process to begin to do this. Generally, our knowledge of ecology is poorly developed, and in a strict sense, the objectives of environmental policy may seem unrealistic since we have insufficient knowledge for making policy judgments. However, if we waited for complete knowledge before modifying the environment, we never would be able to act. Environmental policy, therefore, has a proximate purpose, which is to promote governmental actions consistent with an ecological point of view and the best available ecological knowledge, including, of course, knowledge about man-made life-supporting systems. The second issue that I would like to raise here is that both the federal and state governments need better ways of monitoring their own activities, such as road building and public works construction, for example, to determine the environmental impact of their activities. The problem here stems from the fact that in the growth of the American political system, separate agencies have been established to handle public responsibilities for a particular portion of the natural environment. Either we've set up an agency to handle a given resource or a given land use, we've also set up agencies for fisheries and for forestry, for recreation, and now we're setting up separate agencies for water and for air pollution control. And each of these separate agencies has become highly specialized with respect to its particular function, and each has become surrounded by specialized pressure groups attempting to influence public policies to serve their particular needs and values. But no one, absolutely no one, in public life is charged with concern for the total environment. And as a result, each separate agency that we've established may be doing its job very well, yet each may and often is contributing unknowingly, unavoidably, or unconcernedly to overall environmental deterioration. I think there are many examples that we can see of this. We set up an agency to control water pollution, and if this agency is very effective, industry must do something with its pollutants, so there's a tendency to put it into the air. So the next agency has to be established to do something about the air pollution problem, and it may do its job very effectively. And where are we going to put the pollutants? It must go in the land someplace or in some other form to put it in the sea or something. This approach of establishing a separate agency to handle a single problem leads to this sort of thing, rather than taking a systems approach to waste management, for instance, at looking at the whole waste management problem rather than just its parts. Otherwise, we find that we're going around in circles. And this leads to a third and closely related issue, which is the need for better institutional mechanisms to encourage more effective federal, state, and local collaboration on environmental problems. These environmental problems are so numerous and they're so pervasive that they tend to cut across all the existing political jurisdictions and hence become the responsibility of all levels of government, or in some cases of no level of government. Everyone passes the buck. This fact is one of the principal reasons behind existing and proposed federal legislation in such areas as water pollution, air quality, and waste disposal, which rely heavily on the participation of the states and, to a certain extent, local governmental units in a cooperative program to attack these problems. It cannot be done by any single unit. They must all play a part in it. A fourth issue involves the case of private activities affecting the environment. There is a need for restructuring of economic incentives and penalties associated with these activities wherever this is possible. There is, for example, some economic literature, quite a bit of economic literature now, exploring the idea of building environmental effects, say in the case of water pollution, into the cost and price structure of the industrial activity producing the adverse effects. The objective here is to minimize environmental damage by treating the problem as a user cost rather than as a subject for formal administrative regulation by government or as a matter to be handled through public funds to clean up after it's been done. This is a matter of shifting the cost and the responsibility for certain activities influencing the environment, to shift these costs and responsibilities from the government back onto those who perpetrate the environmental damages. This has been tried in various places. The Ruhr Valley in Germany has had the Ruhr River Valley has had very successful workings with this approach to their problem by placing user costs on those who would pollute the river. The costs are high enough that if you so desire to pollute, the government will come in and clean up after you. But the costs are also so high that it's likely that all industries will do something about cleaning up their effluent before they put it back in the river. We have experimented in this in various ways in this country, but we need to do much more along this line. And as I say, there's a great deal of economic literature coming out indicating various possibilities in this direction. The feasibility of such approaches from a legal and a legislative standpoint is one of the crucial issues of environmental policy, which needs to be explored in much greater depth. Lawyers, as you probably know, are becoming much more active in this regard. We have established in the United States the Environmental Defense Fund, which I'm sure many of you have heard, in which this group is going out and bringing cases before the court and attempting to challenge the right to pollute through the courts and to work in this fashion. And of course there are such people as Nader's Raiders and others who are attempting a different approach. But this is an area of public policy with respect to the environment that needs to be given a great deal more attention, and I think is applicable to the Alaska scene. Finally, the fifth point that I'd like to raise, that with the mounting concern about environmental problems, there is need for new techniques which assure more effective participation of private citizens in environmental decision making. What new institutional and legal mechanisms, for example, are best calculated to assure fair consideration of the views of private persons and groups concerned about environmental issues without blocking or unduly delaying private or governmental developments which may serve the public? Are there effective ways to promote the development of a genuine forum for the broadest public discussion of environmental problems? And are there techniques to assure expeditious resolution of environmental policy issues while taking full account of private objections? These are some critical questions I think that this conference must give due consideration. And an intensive exploration of these five central issues that I've brought up here of environmental policy and try to relate these all to the Alaska scene is obviously not possible within the limits of my talk here this morning. But what I intend to do instead is to focus on steps that might be taken immediately by the state government to get its own environmental house in order. It may be easier to grasp what is involved in this by referring to recent experience elsewhere. And then tomorrow maybe I can bring up some of my own ideas as to specific courses of action that this group might consider. During the last 2 years, there has been a concerted effort to establish a national policy for the environment. The history of this merits consideration, since some of the institutional techniques and approaches may be directly relevant to the creation of a state policy for the environment in Alaska. I think this is particularly true since the strong executive form of government here in the state of Alaska resembles that of the federal government to a certain extent, at least much more so than is the case with most other state governments. So some of the things being tried at that level may definitely have application here. The principal advocate in Congress of a national environmental policy, as you know, perhaps, has been Senator Henry Jackson of Washington, chairman of the Senate Interior and Insular Affairs Committee. Similar proposals to Jackson's have been advanced by Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin and Senator Edmund Muskie of Maine, and by several other members of the House of Representatives. Altogether, there have been some 15 or 20 different bills introduced in Congress dealing with this question of developing a national policy for the environment. But as I say, with Senator Jackson's more or less taking the lead, Senator Jackson has been assisted in devising and promoting his legislation by many outside of Congress, most notably by Professor Linton K. Caldwell, professor of political science at Indiana University, who has written extensively about environmental policy and administration in recent years. The earliest Jackson bill that was introduced in the 90th Congress a couple of years ago contained two basic elements. First, it proposed a program of ecological research and surveys to be carried out by the Department of the Interior. And second, it proposed creation of a Council on Environmental Quality in the Executive Office of the President, the very highest level in the executive structure. This council would provide a point within the federal government at which responsibility for the environment as a whole could be fixed. It was designed after the highly successful Council of Economic Advisors, also lodged in the Office of the President, which is the point in government, of course, where there is responsible for the economy as a whole rather than segments. And as I say, the council established in 1946 with the passage of the Council of Economic Advisors established in 1946 with the passage of the Full Employment Act of 1946 has had quite a successful life during that whole period, having some ups and downs depending on who was the president and how much they wanted to use the Council of Economic Advisors, but nevertheless a most influential oversight function being performed in terms of the impact of government operations on the economy generally. Through the proposed Council on Environmental Quality that Jackson proposed, the president would have access to a continuing overview of the American environment. On the basis of the advice rendered to him, the president would submit legislation, an annual report actually, to Congress, and legislation to Congress. The council device offers a way of surmounting the partial view of environmental problems obtained from individual federal agencies, which have limited jurisdictions, no authority to analyze the total environmental impact of their programs, and a tendency to promote the rather narrow economic interests associated with the resources they administer. Those were the provisions of Jackson's first bill, largely because of his influential position as Interior Committee Chairman. Senator Jackson was able to advance his bill during the present 91st Congress, and negotiations with other congressmen and with the Nixon administration and with Senator Muskie, who was pressing his own bill, negotiations among these groups have produced some modifications in the bill. It's now before a conference committee between the House and the Senate and is expected to become law very shortly, as the National Environmental Policy Act of 1969. And I'd like to take a look at some of the provisions of this bill that looks like it very definitely will pass. The revised bill contains three elements. First, it retains this council device that was in the earlier bill, but the name was changed from the Council on Environmental Quality to the Board of Environmental Advisors. This was done primarily, I think, to distinguish Jackson's proposed agency, to distinguish this Board of Environmental Advisors from the already existing President's Environmental Quality Council, which is an interagency advisory committee composed of the various department heads. This latter was set up by President Nixon in May of this year, and it's as I say, it's a regular interagency advisory committee. And that kind of organizational mechanism of interagency advisory committees suffers from various weaknesses, in that generally interagency advisory committees can only make decisions on non-controversial matters. If things really get tough between the departments, they find it very difficult for various political reasons to come to an agreement. So an interagency committee usually produces the lowest common denominator type decisions. And as I say, that was a step in the right direction, I think, at the national level, to have this interagency committee established. But it was Senator Jackson's view and others who looked at this that it was not enough, and that there was need to create an altogether new instrumentality that could provide a genuine overview of environmental policy throughout the federal governmental structure. The new Board of Environmental Advisors is to be composed of 3 full-time members appointed by the President with the advice and consent of the Senate, and it is intended that they will be persons of broad experience and training with the competence and judgment to analyze and interpret trends and developing problems in the quality of the nation's environment. The Board is authorized to employ a staff and to carry on continuing studies and analyses concerning the status of the environment, and to devise an effective system of environmental indicators to try to determine just how do we measure what we're talking about when we speak of environmental quality or environmental degradation. We need some new indicators or some indicators on which to determine what direction we're actually going. This will be one of the functions of the Board, in order to try to be able to try to relate trends in environmental conditions to both short and long-term national goals. The Board is required to submit an annual report to the President on the state and condition of the environment, and the President, in turn, is similarly required to transmit an annual environmental quality report to Congress along with any suggested legislation. Perhaps one of the most important functions of this new board is its powers to review and appraise all federal programs and to require these agencies to submit needed information concerning the impact of their activities on the quality of the environment. I think this is quite an historic step. It's beginning to force the shoe on the other foot, so to speak, that the agencies will have to or can be required to begin to look at their own activities as it affects the environment. It is also intended that the board will become the one place in the federal government to which the public and the news media can turn for authoritative and objective information on particular environmental problems, and especially those involving conflicts among federal agencies. A second important aspect of the Jackson legislation is that it spells out for the first time and at some length a statement on national environmental policy. This is a major innovation, and the success of the entire legislation, of course, depends on the implementation of these goals and objectives as they are laid out in this National Environmental Policy Statement. The policy statement explicitly accepts the stewardship of the environment as a national responsibility for this and future generations. And it asserts congressional recognition of each person's fundamental and inalienable right to a healthy environment, as well as the corresponding responsibility of each citizen for the protection and enhancement of the environment out of respect for the rights of others. It requires each federal agency to conduct a thorough and continuous evaluation of its own actions as they affect the environment, and a justification in terms of national policy of unavoidable adverse environmental effects. If an agency finds that there will be, as a result of its actions, adverse environmental effects, it must study these, and if there are no alternatives, then it must justify going ahead on the basis of other national goals that supersede it. I think this last is especially significant since it will require a major reevaluation of nearly all federal programs, a self-reevaluation to a large extent. The third major section in the legislation gives every federal agency the authority to undertake necessary programs of ecological research. This is in contrast to Jackson's earlier bill, which would have concentrated most of the federal ecological research in the Department of the Interior. I think this is a much stronger and much better way to approach the problem, and that it gives each agency, in one stipulation, it requires them to make a self-evaluation, and this stipulation, it gives them the powers and authority to undertake the necessary kind of ecological research they will need to do in order to make that self-evaluation. So it's making this become a pervasive thing throughout the government rather than one single agency trying to be responsible for the whole thing as an overseeing the whole operation of the government. Under these stipulations, then, each agency will have the responsibility of designing and conducting its own program of investigations and research relating to ecological systems and environmental quality to the extent needed in carrying out the intent of the national environmental policy. The provision will tend to integrate, as I said, ecological considerations into the decision-making process of those agencies whose programs influence the environment. In addition, one of the existing departments will be designed or designated, one of the existing departments in the federal structure will be designated to coordinate and oversee all ecological research, to keep track on all the ecological research that's going on among the various other agencies, and to assist and advise state and local governments and private enterprise in developing programs and procedures of research and so forth to enhance the quality of the environment. There will be one agency that will be taking a little bit more lead in this whole area of ecological research, but as I say, the most important thing is it will become, if this national policy actually is carried into effect as envisioned, it will become a very pervasive approach throughout the government. The National Environmental Policy Act will greatly enhance the federal government's capability to deal with critical problems of environmental degradation, and especially those resulting from its own activities, There is one notable weakness, I think, and this is the failure of Congress to create a congressional committee to review and act on the annual environmental quality report that will be presented to it by the President each year. As already mentioned, the report will be prepared originally by the President's Board of Advisors and transmitted to Congress by the President, along with legislative recommendations. And the problem is that under its present committee structure, Congress lacks a mechanism for dealing with the overall environmental implications of legislation. And I think this problem is even more serious in most state legislatures. I spoke of the way we fractured the environment in the executive branch of government on a resource-by-resource basis. The same exists, of course, in most state legislatures and certainly in Congress, so that there is no one committee in Congress that can take an overall view of the environment. And as a result, there is a pulling and hawing among congressional committees to try to get control of this and to try to get control of that. Oftentimes, a bill dealing with some environmental matter will have to go to several congressional committees before it can get through the hopper. There is a need, I think, a definite need, and it's fully recognized by many people in Congress, for the Congress itself to get its house in order so it can handle environmental policy problems better. And I think the same applies to state legislatures, and I'll want to say something more about this later, but I believe it's something that this group should be thinking about here too. The success of the Jackson bill depends on a number of variables. Of course, one of the important ones is the prestige of the three men appointed by the President as his advisors. And also, it depends on the interpretation by the agencies themselves and the Congressional Appropriations Committees of the language in the policy statement, how they really interpret this, and the funding made available for the sections dealing with research, which is a very critical point. Also, of course, the success depends very much on the attitude of the President, and if he wants to use it, it will be there for him to use. If he doesn't, of course, it will not serve a large function. Despite these and other uncertainties, however, the Jackson bill offers hope for federal policies that are much more sane than they have been in the past. Unfortunately, among state governments, there has been relatively little interest in environmental policy in the sense described here. The available evidence indicates that state governments tend to favor separate agencies for specific aspects of environmental policy, such as water pollution, air pollution, solid waste disposal, or pesticide control. And this has resulted in an increased fracturing of the environment among an ever-expanding number of separate special purpose agencies. In common with federal activities up to the present, state efforts at environmental administration have also been incremental, with new environmental management functions being placed in agencies designed for other purposes or in new agencies created in response to federal legislation requiring an organizational point of reference for grant and aid disbursements. Overall, the states have a much more severe problem of fragmentation than is the case in the federal government, which is certainly bad enough. A number of factors make the attainment of environmental policy at the state level very difficult. The symbiotic relationship between agencies and clientele groups is much more intense among the states than it is nationally. And the strength of this relationship perpetuates the fragmented governmental structure. In addition, competition between states and among states for industries seeking new locations, weakens the incentives for states to enact firm environmental controls. It's for this reason, of course, that federal standards and guidelines have become necessary, for example, in the setting up of water quality standards and in the air quality program. In those few states that have moved in the direction of institutionalizing a policy for the total environment, strong political leadership has come from the governor. State legislatures in most states are poorly equipped to receive and evaluate scientific and technical knowledge relevant to environmental policy. At the national level, concern for and debate about environmental quality has been growing, as you know, for at least 10 years, but the Council of State Governments still does not have an environmental policy heading in the index of the volumes, in the index of its journal or its monthly bulletin. They still don't even refer to environmental policy, nor have any of the volumes of suggested state legislation published by the Council of State Governments contained recommended environmental policy legislation. The Council of State Governments is an influential group among the states, and it is disappointing to find it referring to what are now widely recognized as environmental problems by the old label of natural resource issues. Still a fractured approach. Some few states have made a beginning. California in 1968 created a state environmental quality council with largely ex officio members to make a thorough study of the problems of environmental quality and to recommend regional or local mechanisms that might formulate broad policies, objectives, and criteria for a coordinated environmental policy. The governor of Maine in April of this year created a task force on the Maine environment to develop a comprehensive plan for the state's future. The governor of Vermont in May of 1969 established by executive order a commission on environmental quality control to prepare comprehensive environmental legislation, including the establishment of a permanent environmental control commission. The governor of Kentucky fought for and won approval of a package of environmental legislation in the last 2 years. New York has debated passage of a constitutional amendment to establish as state policy the protection of scenic beauty and natural resources. The last session of the Washington State Legislature considered but did not pass a reorganization bill to combine agencies for water and air pollution control and solid waste disposal in a new Department of Environmental Quality. The governor of Washington, Dan Evans, has been active in environmental planning through sponsorship of two statewide conferences. Design for Washington was one of them, and Decisions for Progress another. The governor has also called a special session of the Washington State Legislature to meet early in January, primarily to consider several measures urgently needed in that state to attack the growing problems of environmental deterioration. And he is prepared to resubmit a revised and greatly strengthened bill to create a Department of Environmental Quality. This listing, although incomplete, indicates that some states have tried or are contemplating trying several different mechanisms for environmental policy improvement. Combining this information with the approach of the Jackson Bill and other similar proposals before Congress, there's a range of alternative institutional mechanisms that can be suggested based on what has been tried or is contemplated. And each of these mechanisms has different implications and each have different strengths and weaknesses. And I would like to take a few more minutes here and run through this range of alternatives, which I think maybe when you get in your discussions, you will want to think about these different alternatives. First of all, is the taking a look at the executive, the problems in the executive branch of government, arrangements that focus on the chief executive. The first one that I would like to mention is the proposal for an independent executive advisory council. The model here with the independent executive advisory council is, as I said earlier, the Council of Economic Advisors. This, of course, is the approach that Senator Jackson is taking in his Board of Environmental Advisors. This is an independent executive advisory council. One of the strengths of this council approach is that it's located in the executive branch of government at a high enough level that it can give full consideration to the range of environmental problems facing government. One of the problems with this approach is that its effectiveness is limited to a large extent to advice and recommendations, and that the prestige and influence of such a council at that level of government is likely to fluctuate depending upon the caliber of the council members and the willingness of the chief executive, whether it be a president or a governor, to back up the council politically and to use it. Another arrangement at the executive level is an executive office for environmental quality. Most chief executives already have staff support agencies within the office of the chief executive. In the case of the president, there's the Office of Science and Technology, and in many states, the governor has an Office of State Planning. It's a possibility to use that mechanism, these mechanisms, by beefing them up or establishing divisions within these existing executive offices to provide an oversight on the environment. There are some values of this. It could provide staff support in dealing with the day-to-day environmental policy issues. But there's some problems with this approach too, in that in getting involved in the day-to-day aspects, it's liable to lose the more detached and long-range view obtainable from an independent advisory council composed of people more or less outside government. The third mechanism that might be considered at the executive level is an executive advisory committee, either permanent or temporary. Advisory committees, commissions, and task forces are frequently used mechanism for providing policy guidance. This can help to provide a periodic forum for citizens, legislators, and administrators to share views and information and to formulate policy for the chief executive. But there are problems with this. It frequently lacks adequate staff, and conflicts among members tend to lead to ineffective, least common denominator type decisions. And of course, in most cases, these are temporary and do not serve an overall view over time. Do not provide an overall view over time. There are then outside of these arrangements that I've mentioned, there are possibilities for interdepartmental arrangements. Interdepartmental coordinating and advisory committees are legion, as I mentioned earlier. The Environmental Quality Council, created by President Nixon in May of this year, as I pointed out, is of this type. And as I say, this mechanism has been fairly extensively studied in a variety of policy contexts, and the conclusions are almost uniformly unfavorable. At most, this mechanism allows an exchange of information among its members, At worst, it sidetracks basic policy issues, and that it has no authority to resolve. Then there are other approaches. There are departmental arrangements that may be considered, as some state governments have. A Department of Environmental Quality at the federal level has been proposed over the years many times to transform the Interior Department into a Department of Natural Resources or a Department of Conservation or a Department of the Environment. And recently there has been a proposal for creating a Department of the Environment at the national level, and it's now being considered by Congress. Probably won't get very far. This reorganization, trying to reorganize existing agencies, as you know, is very difficult and presents a great stumbling block. The Washington legislature has had before it this proposal for a Department of Environmental Quality, which is really merely amalgamating existing agencies for air and water pollution and waste disposal. One of the things that can be said in favor of the departmental approach is that it does provide a mechanism to bring these diverse groups together for the first time and to begin to take an overall view of the environment at that level. But there are problems with the departmental approach. In the first place, it's hard sometimes to reorganize and reorganization proposals frequently generate intense political and bureaucratic struggles. And then the department is also in a location within the executive branch that it's more difficult for it to take an overall view when there is a conflict between departments or among departments than is the case if you have an organizational mechanism established at the executive level, at the office of the president or in the governor's office. There are other approaches, such as an Office of Ecological Research. This approach would place within an existing department an office for the promotion and coordination of ecological research, as was proposed by Senator Jackson in his first draft of his bill, to try to get some knowledge of the ecological problems, some research on these problems underway, which is certainly a great need for this. But placing this department or placing this function within one department is liable to appear threatening to other departments with environmental responsibilities, and I don't think is at all as effective as the Jackson approach of trying to get ecological research being more widely conducted throughout the whole governmental structure as each agency reevaluates its own programs. But that is a possibility, an Office of Ecological Research somewhere within one of the existing departments. The other alternative, of course, is to set up mechanisms that will allow each department to conduct ecological research on its own, as I've already mentioned. There are then, moving on, legislative arrangements that can be considered to try to get the legislature to order its own house, order itself, so that it can handle environmental problems more effectively. There have been some proposals here at the national level that may be useful from the point of view of a state. There is a proposal for a joint committee on environmental quality. And this joint committee on environmental quality would be modeled after the joint committee on the economic report, which was created in conjunction with the Council of Economic Advisors in 1946. There is also the possibility of establishing a select committee on the environment, or select committees on the environment, one in the House and one in the Senate, so that most all environmental bills would go to this select committee. I don't have time to go into all these ramifications, and I'm going to ask John if these notes that I have on the pros and cons of these various mechanisms cannot be reproduced some way and made available to the group here. there are possibilities at the, looking at the legislature again of a of creating a temporary legislative advisory committee. This mechanism has been used quite frequently at the national level.